at least not that I'm aware of. So it doesn't have niceties like Vox and noise cancellation and other stuff, which runs in that little module. So it works, but it doesn't have a lot of the good things that you really need to be a polite Zoomer using etiquette.
Do any of the other ones like Jitsi or Google Meet or anything, do any of those work?
I don't know. I've really only tried Zoom. I probably should be a little bit more adventurous, but I've not been.
There's a bunch of choices.
Yes, there are quite a few. I know we talked about it. We do like a regular Zoom meeting every week for Scotty's company, and we're talking about, we've been using the free version, and the problem with the free version is it cuts off after 40 minutes. And no matter how you try, it's hard to get a meeting shorter than 40 minutes.
Well, Dave and I use Jitsi most every week and on Linux, and that works well for it, but we've never tried it on an ARM.
Well, I see Nathaniel's here, and we're past
yes.
the clock. So.
Hello, how are you? I guess I'll start recording to the cloud. There you go.
Greetings.
Greetings. Well,
welcome, everybody, to the May 11th, 2021 session of Tangerine STR and HAMSCI technical session. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week, I've been doing a few little projects and dealing with some family issues, and also dealing with getting ready to teach. I have a class next week, which is, I've taught it several times, but it's 8 hours a day for 5 days and a lot of field work. So it's kind of fun, but it takes up a big chunk of time. Anyway, and I will be here for next Monday night, so it should all work fine. So next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Things are going fine here. We're in the last week of classes for this semester at the University of Scranton. I have been working with the different students. And Dev, we're trying to get some presentations put together to give it the Super Darn workshop. And I've also started the process of, I'd like to put one of these magnetometers at my house this summer. So I started working with our person at the university, Majid, who's going to help me build that. And I've reached out to Dave Witten and to, into Jules and a couple other people. And they said they would help us with the instructions. So I'm hoping we can get together an actual like manual document for how to do this, and we can get it installed, and hopefully I'll be able to be on the magnetometer bandwagon as well. So W2NAF, back to Nat.
Very good. And next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Good evening to you, and good evening to the net. Is my sound okay?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, very good. Well, my students finished their finals week before last, and so now they're able to work. I found we were able to get them to work, a couple of the undergraduates to work throughout the summer, so we can make some progress on the central system. And we're about ready to test the heartbeat. I can get the local host to do a heartbeat to the central system and get back the appropriate response. And my student told me, okay, if you go into the admin and admin UID and request it, you can request a given block of data, which I just have to set up the software to recognize the bookends of the start and end times and upload it. He neglected to give me the password for the admin account though. So anyway, we'll get a Zoom call scheduled with him and the rest of the team tomorrow and make some progress on that. Other progress has been very, very slow. There is a something oddball going on with the grape. Nathaniel, I don't know if we were planning on trying to run the grape, doing spectrum collection and in Antarctica for the upcoming Antarctic winter or whatever, but there's something that causes that software to crash. It will run for a few days and then it gets an error. And I don't know if this is due to a memory leak or something. I'm trying to nail it down to figure out whether the problem is in GNU radio or digital RF. So I haven't yet nailed that down, but that is a little bit of an issue. So other things have been going rather slowly because I upgraded my Flex radio to the latest software, and it broke a few things. And when you have a system like that, you like everything to work on it. So it provides the ability to connect to it remotely with something like an iPhone. And it took me 4 hours this morning of hacking around, getting to where that remote app would work again. But finally, we got it, and you're going to have to reprogram everything because in order to do it, you had to do a factory reset. So you know how that goes. Anyway, that's where this thing stands from here in Northport, Alabama. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, I have Bill in 8ET. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I've been busy here with the grape. I got the Raspberry Pi. I got the image downloaded and loaded on the Pi, and it came up and displayed FLDigi, so I think it works. I also got all the parts in for the grape, and I've been looking at it because it's all surface mount and pretty small, as you all know. So to get in shape for soldering, I've started building another kit, 40 meter CW kit that I'll use on field day, and learning how to solder again, one-handed, left-handed, and went along really well until I put one part in the wrong place and had to pull the part out, and then I couldn't get the solder out of the holes with the solder sucker or a sucking gun. So finally, I just tack soldered the part on that needed to be there. So I'm making progress on that. It'll be another day or two, and then I'll start looking at the grape again and trying to decide. I figured I probably could do most of it, and then I noticed there's a little tiny dial down in the bottom left corner of the board that is just about small enough that I can't hardly see it, and I'm sort of wondering if I can get my hand steady enough to hold the part there and solder that in place. But got three boards and three sets of parts, so I think one of those will at least make it through. So maybe by next week I'll have something to report on that. But the other thing I got on the grape meeting on Thursday at 10 o'clock, 3 o'clock, whatever, and the meeting wasn't there. And I found, I went to this site meeting because you can get on there anytime. And there were two other fellows that were getting on, couldn't find the meeting either, and none of us knew what was going on. So that was kind of a lost cause. But I'll try it again this week. So that's about it. Back to you.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Brian, AD2BA. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, I'm on limited bandwidth, so I hope you can all hear me. I am new to HamSci. I learned about it the other week from some correspondence through my latest QEX article. I'm a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and I just thought this was interesting, so I thought I would check in and say hello. So that's all for me. Back to Ned.
Well, Brian, welcome, and please come back if you find it interesting. I hope you do. So next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Not much to report. I mentioned last week that I'm working on magnetic loop antenna, and I just got the last of the parts this afternoon. And since I have a day off tomorrow, I will try to get things put together. So kind of looking at that as maybe being a good answer for what we're doing here. A nice little receiving loop would work, and even a simple transmitting loop, I think, would work. And because the power levels will probably be very low for transmitting. We could probably do it with a fairly simple MagLoop antenna without, you know, $400 vacuum variables, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's the news from here. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Again, not a whole lot. I've been working on some 3D printed mountings for magnetometers, but these are designed for boards I've built, not the ones that Scotty made. And I think that what Jules is documenting is doubtless quite different. I'm also been doing something else. Can't remember what it was. Anyway, just plodding along and mostly minding my own business as best I can. Thanks, and back over to you.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have David, N1HAC. Go ahead, David. Mike?
There we go. I was switching screens. Yeah, I've been busy trying to put together VLF ground station. Murphy's having a heyday, let's put it that way. I just hope O'Neill doesn't show. I think it's O'Neill that said that Murphy was an optimist. but yeah, I'm working on that. We've got our rocket project coming up end of the month. Current first chance to launch is May 26th. I noticed that our predecessor, or the one coming before us, has been making the news because it's a chemical release flight from Wallops, and some of us on the East Coast may be able to see it. But I don't know that it has even flown yet. It was supposed to fly a couple days ago, but weather and other things are getting in the way, as they do with our rockets. One other thing I'm going to bring up, which is why I'm fascinated by the higher frequency propagation. I was on the air two nights ago, between 10 o'clock and midnight local time. Just happened to take a look on 10 meters FT8. Ended up making about 20 contacts from everywhere. Let's see. I got Texas, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Kentucky, California. 10 meters around midnight. Go figures. And then as I was about to go to bed, I just said, well, let's take a look at 6 meters. I made a contact in Illinois and 2 in Wisconsin. So this is an interesting field to be in, let me put it that way. Back to Matt.
Fine business. Yes, I noticed I run a Whisper beacon and both transmitter and receiving multiband. And things picked up a little bit in the last week.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, wasn't able to make contact, but I saw Edmonton, I think, or was it Winnipeg? Anyway, it was way out there in Canada, and also saw California on 6 meters at midnight.
Yes.
So you never know.
Never know. So next on the list is Hillman Kim, KD2MRC. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. Well, I haven't really done much this week. I'll be working on the documentation so that we can, once the magnetometers are distributed, then people can look at that documentations to follow the procedures for easy installation and stuff. But otherwise, yep, that's all I can say for now. Back to Matt.
Fine business. Sorry, Dev, I jumped over you. Go ahead.
It's for me?
Yes.
Okay, because there are quite a few Devs here. So we're doing well. And I'm literally stuck in a rabbit hole while debugging a code that I have written. It works for one set of data, but doesn't work for another set of data. So I was planning that I would try to debug it today, which I could not. So I am thunking the rabbit hole for today and tomorrow. Thank you.
Very good. Well, keep at it. Next on the list is James, KG4DSG.
Can't get the buttons working. Evening all, evening to the net. I'm just sitting here watching disk spin. I'm trying to move off of a 10-year-old AMD system to the replacement tower, and it's multiple terabytes, and even disk to disk, it's taking hours. So I'll just sit back, watch the disks, and listen in. Back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list is JWB8SBI.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. Nothing really new here to report the past couple of weeks. I've had some health problems here. Had to have some surgery last week and recovering. So I'm now trying to get back into things. In terms of radio, I still have to put together my test bench here so I can get the parts from my Zoom DigiKey, get all my soldering tools purchased, et cetera, and get my my bench up and running so I can actually build this thing, the grape, which I'm very much looking forward to doing. On a cybersecurity related note, those of you that are into automotive cybersecurity or cybersecurity in general, the premier conference for embedded systems in cars, ESCAR, SCAR, takes place this week, Wednesday and Thursday. So just Google SCAR, and if you're into embedded security, that is one of the conferences you really want to attend. Nathaniel, as I was doing surfing around this past weekend on FT8, I heard Whiskey Alpha 2 November Alpha Foxtrot. I wasn't able to get them because propagation winked out on me, but it was like I definitely did a double take on that to have to stop and think for a moment. Wait a minute here. Is that or is that not the real Nathaniel? So you've got at least know that WA2NAF is an active call sign and it's out there. Other than nice. That, nothing really else to report. And considering my health is now improving, I'm recovering, as they say in the military, after a successful mission. Glad to be here, boss. Take care, guys. 7-3, back to net control.
Well, and we wish you the best in your recovery. Next on the list, we have Jim, K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim. Mike, microphone.
I was on a net earlier this evening. We were talking about what we had done at ham radio this week, and I couldn't think of much of anything I'd done. I try to think on this, and I can't think of much of anything I've done either. I did get the website for the Grape Help. I got the information on it that I wanted, but I'm not real happy with the presentation of the information. I may dork with that a little bit at some point, too. But at least it's there. And I determined that, it was the op amp on my grape that is not was not working. So I've got the old one pulled off and ready to put the new one on. I did a little bit of damage to the PC board, but I think I can recover from it. Otherwise, unfortunately, not a lot of progress to report.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Joe, W7LUX. Go ahead, Joe. Joe, your microphone's still muted.
Yeah. I don't know how to get this thing to stay on. Okay. Good evening, everybody. I've been watching the grape collect data. It doesn't appear to be going anywhere, but it is collecting data. Been monitoring the list, and I haven't seen anybody raise any questions. Had one person who had a similar result to my rather wild fluctuations on the 25th of last month, but no questions on the email list. And let's see, my system has been running for a number of days now, and no crashes. the ESD part, that little tiny SO23 gadget. How I got mine on, first of all, I couldn't get it on the first board, but I did stick it on a second board. And how I did that is I wet the one ground pad and slid it on there from a piece of paper. I tried grabbing one of them in the with a pair of tweezers, and it went jumping off somewhere. I'll never find that, I suspect. But I managed to get it into position under a microscope and held it down with a very small screwdriver while I applied just enough heat to get that ground connection welded to the, or soldered to the ground terminal. And then I went ahead and soldered the other two. But that was my technique for getting it on there. Slid it on the board under the microscope and held it in place with a very small screwdriver, a jeweler screwdriver, while I soldered the one connection. Let's see, 10 meters and 6 meters, bradykey. It's that time of year. So I'm not surprised for having good conditions, even in the wee hours of the morning. And field day, been working on field day antennas here. Girlfriend wants to go out and set up a portable station. So she's recovered pretty much from the hip replacement surgery and been working on getting coax and such for field day antennas. I manage ARES around here. So I pay particular attention. And right now we've just entered fire season, and Yavapai County, the county to the southwest of me, already has a pretty good size fire, a 3,200 acre fire going between them and Maricopa County where Phoenix is. But if I'm not here, it's probably because I'm out helping with ARES type duties. Thanks, Dave.
Well, fine business, and stay safe. Next on the list, we have Jonathan, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. There were two questions that I was thinking about with my board. The first one would be the analog voltage. The IOVDD has to be 1.8 volts. I was going to use 1.8 volts of AVDD also. And I was wondering about any opinions or remarks about using 1.8 volts as the AVDD as opposed to 3.3, which I had originally planned when I was going to use 3.3 volts IOVDD. The other thing that I was thinking about was the clock distribution. So to my knowledge, as I understand it, the differential clock will come into a driver. The output of that driver will connect to the input of a differential to single-ended converter to drive the ADD converter. And then that differential output also will connect to the input of a of another differential driver and then drive the output to the FPGA. And I just wanted to know if I understood that right, just so I could kind of proceed with things. Other than that, my graduation ceremony comes up in 2 weeks. I'm fairly excited about that. Back to the net.
Well, congratulations, Jonathan. I'm glad you're getting to the graduation ceremony, and hopefully they'll have it in person. And next on the list, we have Michael, AAAK. Comments, Michael? Well, fine business. Next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, well, not a lot of, I won't say not a lot of progress, not a lot of interesting things happening this week, but still doing pin swapping and routing on the data engine. And it looks like we're going to have to change the Ethernet chip because they are giving me a 2022 delivery date and I can't find any of them. So I'm not going to wait till 2022 to build this thing. So I think we're going to migrate from a 3-port Ethernet chip to a 5-port Ethernet chip, of which I can get. The only problem is it's a 128-pin package from a 64-pin package, so my CAD guy is going to be ripping his hair out. But I think we have enough room in the – it's in the upper left corner of the board. I think we have enough room to change the part to a 128. So I'm going to talk to him tomorrow about doing that, and we'll be able to buy pretty much all the parts. That the remaining one I can't get or I'm having trouble getting is a September delivery. A lot of the other ones that have been giving me August deliveries, July and August deliveries, they show up on my porch. So they're here. So amen to that. I'll take them early if you give them to me early. No problem with that. So let's see. That's about it for the build. It's actually looking really good. The CAD guy is doing an awesome job in routing and making things look really clean and not cross over. And I think it's going to turn out to be a nice and quiet board if we can keep this up. He's almost done. He's probably more, I'm going to say, 2 iterations. And each iteration is about 25 to 30 signals that I have to move around. And when he's done with that, then we're done, except for the rip up and reroute of the gigabit port. And I tell you what, if I could find a way to put 2 more Ethernet jacks on the thing, I'd put 4 ports on the board because we're going to have 5 on the part. So it seems a shame to just no connect them to anything, but there's just not enough room around the outside of the board to put another dual Ethernet port. And besides that, I'm not sure what we would actually do with it anyway. So anyway, that's it for here. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. It's let me get the video button there. It's been a pretty busy week. I've got the OpenHP SDR, the new radio driver, ported to 3.9 successfully this morning and got the code pushed up to GitHub. The final problem turned out to be a PyBind 11 version problem. And I think the GNU radio instructions were at one time correct, asking you to install a particular version, but they're now no longer correct. And so the version that GNU radio is built against is different than the version that they asked you to install. So we got all that settled, got the right stuff version, and did a brief test this morning. So the code's up and available, it seems to be working. So back to the group.
Tom, yours is 3.9, right?
Yes, 3.9.1.
Good. And I was just wondering. I also wanted to mention something that happened over the weekend that we should all be aware of is John Ackerman gave a talk to GNU. It was the monthly GNU radio talk. And he did a really nice job, and he talked about his Eclipse data that he collected and some new GNU radio modules that he developed to read that Eclipse data and some analysis he did of it. So if you haven't seen that, I'd highly recommend going and finding that video and watching it. He did a really nice job. And he mentioned both Tangerine SDR, Tapper, and Hamsi. So we all got plugged. Also on there, John leaked that DCC will be virtual. And the president of GNU Radio said that they were going to be in person. And they weren't sure exactly if they were going to stay in the same place or not. So
go figure. We're out of tape again.
We'll link up again with them sometime. So anyway, I just thought I'd pass all that on because it is relevant to our project. So we're open for general discussion. Sorry.
Oh, so I'd just like to say hi to Brian, 82BA. I'm an RPI graduate from 1975. Brian's muted.
Hi. Sorry about that. I am also an RPI graduate of 2018 with my doctorate, and then they hired me back in a different school.
So which school are you teaching out of?
So I'm in ITWS now, and I did my doctoral work over in Haas and STS.
OK. Okay, I'm not familiar with any of those acronyms, being a 50-year-old. it's been a long time since I've been to RPI, so.
Been a long time, yeah. So ITWS, that's our Information Technology and Web Science department.
Okay.
I guess nominally we're within the School of Science, but we have a degree of independence outside of the School of Science, which is quite nice. And if you have heard of the Tetherless World constellation that RPI has, we are somewhat aligned with them. They're the semantic web people. They're the ones who are thinking about how to make the web machine readable.
Of course, none of that existed when I graduated, so.
No, probably not.
We had an IBM 370 in the I don't know what building it was called. It was on the main campus there, across from like the green building. I don't know where the computer center is now, but
it's in the VCC now. It's in that old converted church.
Okay.
The supercomputer is on the top floor of that building. It's right across from the library. When you walk out the library, you're looking at it.
Okay. Yeah, this is way on toward the west on the main campus was where the computer used to be, with the sculpture that had these two flat things that went around in opposite directions. And they paid a fortune for this kinetic sculpture, and it did not like ice. And you know what, RPI, ice is everywhere.
Yeah, that's real unfortunate if it did not like ice.
The first winter, one of the pieces was on the ground. And after that, I don't think it ever worked again. So it's just kind of funny. It's like maybe you should consider a static sculpture, you know, a place that gets ice storms.
Yeah. They have a little kinetic sculpture now. It's not all that big, and it manages to survive the winters just fine.
Okay, yeah, this is about 20 feet tall, so it was.
No, this is more like 10 feet tall. I think they may have learned their lesson.
Yeah.
So, Brian, can you give us a little clue what kinds of projects things you're interested about?
Sure, I'm more or less still new to amateur radio. I only got licensed back in July. Really, the only notable thing I did was write a QEX article that's in the current edition of QEX on, really, it's just kind of my first attempt at a protocol for binary transfer over CW.
Okay.
I come from an old school Unix background. I'm a BSD Unix developer and have been for the better part of a decade. I teach the cybersecurity courses here at RPI. I also teach some web development courses here as well in our department. So I also just have had a long-standing interest in citizen science generally. So part of my doctoral work was working with people who are embedded in doing citizen science projects. And so I've just always kind of been interested in that. Some of my research work when I was a graduate student was doing citizen science work. And then I met David Kazin. He reached out to me just correspondence for my QEX article and said, by the way, have you heard of HAMSI? You might be interested. So I said, no, I haven't. And that's kind of silly on my part because, you know, I spend a lot of time doing citizen science. So I'll go check it out. And so I signed up for the mailing list, saw the email for this morning and figured, show up, be here.
Right. So do you belong to W2SED, to the club?
I do not belong to the club. You know, as far as I know, the club is silent, but that may have changed. It's been silent for the last year. WRPI has also been silent. I think it only just recently became unsilent. I think the FCC actually still thinks that WRPI is silent. I don't think they've updated their database about that. Right. And it's nothing about the students. It really was just kind of the results of the current state of affairs around the world, more than anything else.
I was just curious because when I was there, SED was, they probably had between 50 and 100 members, and it was a very active club in the VHF contest and everything. So it'd be interesting to see how many recruits we could get for HAMSI out of the W2SED group if they're active still. But if they're kind of one, I know university radio clubs tend to go up and down with how many students there are who are active at that time, and then they graduate and then there's nobody.
Yes.
And
right. And I think part of it too is, you know, in the fall, we're supposed to be back to normal. Whether or not that's true, we'll see. But presuming, I would imagine things being back to normal in the fall would also just kind of help grow the numbers again, because right, the students will be there, they'll be close to the station, and life will be a lot more easier for them in that regard.
So you've been shut down for the past year?
We have been doing what we are nominally calling hybrid for the past year, which was, I would have, let's say, a class of 40 students, I'd have 20 of them in person right in front of me in the classroom, and the other 20 online simultaneously.
Okay. Because the last I heard at RPI, they basically, the university kicked out all the residents.
They did. We kicked everybody out right after spring break last year. And we transitioned entirely online for the remainder of last spring. And then we've done this whole year of this kind of half and half model, which I guess has been, you know, the best that could be done given the circumstances, but I'm really kind of looking forward to having all the students back in person.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Interesting. Thanks for the update. I haven't been to RPI in ages, and, you know, I still remember the lectures with, you know, 200 or 300 people, and then the recitations with 20 or 30. And
yep, they still do that here.
Yeah. And is the physics lecture still the magic show? Or was it before the shutdown?
You know, I don't know. I was never close to the physics department.
Okay, the physics lectures were the physics professors always had some magical exploding, burning, you know, some kind of spectacular thing to show us.
No, I've been here for 6 years. I've never heard of that. So
okay, things have changed.
Plus must be gone.
Yeah, that's too bad.
That sounds good, though.
It was the magic show, and it was always, it kept attendance up, though, because you never knew what they were going to do.
So. I'll just mention, I did a little research on W2SZ. The license is still good until 2025. And I will point out that there is a group for college amateur radio stations that, if you're interested, you might get involved with.
Yeah, I know I have a handful of students who are licensed themselves, and I've asked them about W2SZ, and they just kind of tell me things have been quiet. We haven't really been having meetings, but that's because nobody's on campus.
Yeah, that's certainly going to be true.
Yeah.
At Dartmouth, we have a college radio club as well, but it's been pretty inactive because we don't have a lot of undergraduates with licenses. But there are a number of us, professors and staff, who keep it alive.
Nathaniel's trying to get the Scranton Club going.
Yeah, we're working on it. So we have a good little core of students that I've gotten interested. And now I'm just trying to get some antennas on the building. And I think it'll happen. But, you know, there are a few challenges with that. But I'm working on it. Got some antennas up at my house, which is not that far. And we've done a lot remotely, even during the pandemic, using the Kiwi SDRs. So you could go to kiwisdr.com and you can do shortwave listening with that. And that's worked out really nicely with the students.
So you need any antennas, Nathaniel?
Do I need any antennas for the university?
I've got a couple of three beams laying around that have been laying around for years that could see some use. So if you need any monobanders,
yeah, if I could, I mean, that would be nice. I have a room to put them up at my house, but I think the tower maintenance is scaring us right now.
Yeah, so, I know. At ASU, they went to like certified climbers only.
Yeah,
so that means it's just tremendously expensive.
Right, and that's even to put modest antennas up right now. It's horrendously expensive, but I'm working on it. So.
We'll just go out there on the weekend when no one's around. And
I know NJIT, they have their two towers up. It was installed in the 70s by students with a gin pole. So
yeah,
you know, don't think that happens anymore.
Hope you don't drop the antenna through the roof or something, because
yeah,
you'd have to move out of state.
Yeah.
By the way, I'll mention that our trustee, shoot, now I just lost his name, Hansen, K-K-2-V-U-N, I think. Anyway, Eric Hansen, he actually teaches SDR in his digital electronics class. So we might be able to tag him and his students for little help when this project gets going and needs a little bit more FPGA help.
By the way, that's another part that I have on the short list. I don't have any FPGA delivery date yet. And without an FPGA, we don't have much of anything. So
can you use a slower part, at least to develop?
Everything's 12 weeks lead time.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not convinced that asking, in fact, I might actually get it sooner asking for the oddball part.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the thing is that the procedure here is so long and convoluted because being an Altera / Intel partner, we have to go through all the proper channels to get the part approved. I mean, it's been on the list as the part we're going to use for like a year, more than a year. But we have to go through to get the pricing, and then we have to go through and get the quote from the distributor, and then we got to get the lead time from the distributor, and then we have to actually place the order before my rep can actually do anything to expedite, because he can only expedite orders. He can expedite, maybe I'll buy one, and I can't place an order until I get a price. And I haven't been able to, and I get a projected price from the rep, but I don't buy them from the rep, I buy them from the distributor. So the distributor has to agree to that price and agree to sell it to me for that price. And then I place the order, and then I can go to my rep and say, okay, 12 weeks is unacceptable. How about next week? And then we fight over where he can scarf up some parts.
It sounds complicated,
right?
Yeah, and it turns out it's interesting because we use five regulators. We use five regulator chips from Empyrean, which is owned by Intel, at least for a little while longer. They sold the division off, but it hasn't gone through yet. The approvals haven't gone through. But they're quoting me 12-week lead time and the same exact price I can get from DigiKey, who has them in stock. So it's like we didn't buy through the distributor or that distributor, because I'm not going to wait 12 weeks for a part I can just go and order and get delivered in 2 days. So anyway, all the regulators I have them already. They're here. And in fact, we have pretty much all the parts, but this is my parts list here, my non-parts list, the ones I don't have. And there's only four parts on it, but it's the Ethernet chip, it's the USB-3 chip, it's the FPGA, and it's the high-performance crystal oscillator. Those are the four parts that I can't get. And the crystal oscillator, I'm supposed to be able to get, it's just I can't get I'm talking to the sales guy, and he can't get the factory to talk to him. And all of their parts are like, they're semi-custom because they're built to certain frequencies. And I even told the guy, hey, look, any frequency between 48 and 52 megahertz will work. Mm-hmm. What standard? What do you make for someone else? Won't talk to me.
What sort of oscillator are we talking about here?
It's made by Raycon.
And what's special about it?
It's special is extremely low phase noise.
Ah.
And expensive, but you know, that's
regular old package, or is it some custom package?
Yeah, it's a it's okay, so it's weird. It's a QFN package, but it is a crystal oscillator mounted on an FR4 substrate, which has the QFN pins around it, and then some extra components around it. So it's kind of like a hybrid,
right?
So I think that's part of the reason it makes it so expensive. I don't know why they did it that way, but maybe for heat isolation.
So what's the nominal frequency that you really do want?
48 to 52.
It doesn't matter.
I said 50. Uh-huh. So something pretty common, right? 50 megahertz.
So it's unrelated to our 122.88.
No, because it'll
anything
be
of that.
No. Now, what it does is it is the oscillator that runs into the synthesizer chip. And the synthesizer chip uses that oscillator for its low phase noise properties and looks at the timing of that with respect to the 10 meg reference to decide when the 10 meg reference has gone out of bounds or out of block and to do holdover.
Uh-huh.
So we could theoretically use virtually any frequency. I'm hoping that they come back with a 50 or a 48 or a 52 or something nice and even, not like a 49.123865, you know, and I don't know what that, where that came from. Or if they come up with something that's divisible by 48 kilohertz, you know, that would, I mean, I don't know what they would have. And I don't care, but it doesn't really matter what I ask for. If they don't talk to me, I'm not going to get anything out of them. And John Ackerman has gotten samples of, and Tom, I don't know, you know what frequency he got? It seems like it was 32 megahertz.
I don't remember. It has to be between 48 and 52 to run the chip. So if you have samples, they won't run the chip.
Well, you probably don't know the answer to this. I'm trying to figure out what the samples were for the evaluation board that he made. Because I've got Raycon parts for that, and I don't know what frequency they are. They got some
numbers. The standard engineering about boards use 48 megahertz.
Okay. At any rate, I've got five samples of those, and we're building the evaluation board. And you guys might not have heard about this, but John Ackerman and Rick Hambly have designed an evaluation board that takes the pieces that are not on the Silicon Labs board that has a synthesizer chip that we use and puts the parts that we use on our clock module on a separate board. So now when you marry the board that you buy from Silicon Labs with the synthesizer on it and this extra evaluation board, now you get the oscillator chain exactly the same as what we have on the clock module. So we'll be able to actually test the real chips because we've been using a different synthesizer and a different oscillator and a different this and a different that, and we're getting approximate idea of what it's going to be like. But when this evaluation board is done, we'll know exactly what it's like because it'll be the same parts that we use. So, and since we're all busy with other stuff, I'm taking the boards actually over. This is the parts kit right here, which you can't see because of my fine business background. But let me show you this. I'll turn off the background so you can see the junk in my room. So this is the module. This is the board. And those up by my index finger and along the bottom here, those are edged on SMAs. And the SMAs come off here and here, and they mate perfectly with the Silicon Labs board. So you can just hook it up with barrel connectors, and you can mate the boards together.
That's pretty cute.
So, yeah, it's gonna be nice when we get it done. And since nobody seems to have any time, we've opted to have the same CM who's going to build all of our boards. He's going to assemble this, and we got the quote, and everything is all approved. Tapper's going to pay for it, and we'll get it back in like a week, and it'll be done.
Scotty, I'd like to ask a question about your Ethernet dilemma.
Sure.
The original plan was a three-port board or a three-port chip, and you were going to bring all three ports out?
One port goes to the FPGA, and two ports come out.
That was the original?
The original are two PHY ports and one MAC port.
That goes okay, so you were basically feeding just a single gig E to all three ports from the FPGA?
Well, it appears as to the FPGA, it appears as a MAC. So it looks like an Ethernet, one Ethernet port. And then, but it goes into a switch fabric so that we can send it out either port. So, it shows up on one Ethernet bus since there were only three. Now, since this is a five port.
What I was thinking about is possible future link aggregation, but if you're limited to a single lane, basically to the FPGA, that really doesn't help.
Yeah, and the one for which? For the KSZ?
Yeah.
Oh, just got to, you have to check these things every day. Nona just said that the latest delivery for the KSZ part now is December 14th. At least it's in 2021 and not in 2022.
So that's the latest date or the year?
That's the one that she just got.
Most upgraded. They've been moving the date up a little bit at a time.
Okay.
So what used to be like mid-2022, and now it's December 2021.
That's an improvement.
It's an improvement. So, but
wow.
But I'm thinking the thing about the seven port or the six port one if we can squeeze it in, it uses a GMII interface instead of an RGMII. And for those of you who don't know what that is, an RGMII is called a reduced gigabit MAC interface. So it uses four transmit bits and four receive bits. So they send a nibble out at a time, which means to get gigabit speeds, you got to send at 125 megahertz and you got to go double data rate, right? So you got to basically clock at 250 megahertz to get a gigahertz out, right? Because you get four bits at a time. So at 125 megahertz, that's only 500 megabits per second. So you got to do double data rate, which means you got to send data out on each edge of a 125 megahertz clock, which is just, this is the reason we need a dash six part, okay? Now, if I use this part here, it has a GMII interface, which is eight bits transmit, eight bits receive, which means you still use 125 megahertz clock, but you clock only on one edge. So it's conceivable I could use a slower speed grade FPGA and this GMII, although I'm a little nervous because the A to Ds have to be clocked to DDR also, and they go at 122.88, which is pretty darn close to 125. So I would keep the high-speed FPGA in order to do that.
Yeah, the receiver has got a double data rate interface, so it's effective. Data rate is 245 megabits per pin.
Right, but the thing is we can use the differential.
Yeah, the differential signaling really helps a lot, plus quieting things down.
And it's LVDS, so it's a lower swing, so it's much lower noise. And the Ethernet is not, it's single-ended. So it's no opportunity to do LVDS or differential with that. But I can go to 8 bits and do half the data rate, which is, that seems to be highly desirable. Although I will have to come up with an extra 8 data pins, 4 transmit and 4 receive to connect up to it. But I think that's worth the headache that that's going to entail.
Yeah, the noise is less when you've got the sender and receiver chips on the same circuit board, not going through a connector.
Yeah, but yeah.
That helps a bunch.
And the question is, you don't really have any real estate to bring the additional ports out. Is that what you were saying before?
Right. I don't have any edges to bring it out. I mean, the top edges have the RF for the RF modules. The left edge is where we bring everything out. It's pretty much full. The bottom edge is where the connectors are for the RF boards that have their RF out the top. And the right-hand side is the upper right has the 40-pin Raspberry Pi compatible connector. So that comes right up to the edge. And the board, the right edge of the Raspberry Pi hat aligns with the right edge of the board. So you can't put anything along there because it would interfere. So theoretically, I guess I could put something at the bottom right, but the problem is that's diagonally opposite to where the gigabit part is. So yeah. The only alternative would be to move the entire gigabit interface over to the right-hand side of the board and put all of the ports over there.
Yeah, Scotty?
Yeah.
You know, a single port Ethernet chip to me seems like a possible fallback solution. Because a 5-port Gigi switch, you know, they're down in the $10-$15 range now. So it wouldn't be beautiful, but, you know, it's pretty cost effective to have an external 5-port switch.
The 3-port switch that we had is about $2 less than the 6-port one. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the cost of the chips is the same. The real estate is bigger because it's a 128-pin package.
Well, yeah, but if we can't get them...
No, I can get the 6-port one. I can't get the 3-port one. So you use the 6-port one, you just don't connect 3 ports. So
I assume you could configure them to just be dead ports.
Just configure them to be dead ports or don't connect anything to them. Yeah. And so I did think about, just put a single PHY on there and just have a single port. Okay, that would work also. But there was a definite advantage to having 2 ports. You don't need a switch to connect to your local network and to the Raspberry Pi. So it seems if we could get this on here, that would be okay. It's just, like I said, it seems a waste to have a 5-port switch and use 2 of the ports. You know, it's like you leave 3 no connects and it's like, wow, what should I do with these? Can I put a header on there? Can I put a daughter card on there with the extra Ethernet?
Well, the link back to the FPGA, though, is still just a single link. So even if you had multiple ports, you'd be spreading the bandwidth out.
It won't help you as far as throughput at all, no.
Right.
It just would be a gimmick, you know, that you could. And I looked for a triple high Ethernet jack, and I couldn't find any. So we're using a double high one now. But they make three side-by-sides, but they don't make double, they don't make triple height ones. You can only get double heights. Although what I did find was I found one that had an Ethernet port in the top and a USB port in the bottom.
So yeah, that's pretty common these days.
Occurred to me I could use a dual Ethernet on one jack, which is what we have, replace the USB port with an Ethernet USB combo, and I'd at least get three ports then instead of five, so I'd only be wasting two ports. But really, I mean, for the $2 difference in price cost of the IC, waste the ports. Doesn't matter. And then I get a slower interface that's easier to interface to. So that's worth something.
It's worth $2.
Worth $2 and the headache of it's actually the $2 doesn't bother me near as much as the hundreds of dollars I'm going to have to pay the CAD guy to rip that up.
Yeah.
It's already routed. And of course, he's already routed that part. So it's go figure, you know, wouldn't be in the area that he hasn't done. He's doing the RF modules right now. So, and Tom, we're going to have to change something on the RF board because I can't give you 1.8 volts. I don't have a 1.8 volt regulator. So, and
yeah, well, I'm not using 1.8 volts on the board. Yes, I do the digital. I'm using them for the digital inputs. Right.
And so you use the VCC IO, which I am giving you, which would be 1.8, except now we've determined that to do LVDS, we have to strap it to 2.5. So now I can't give you 2.5. And, I mean, I can give you 2.5, but it's not going to be what you need. So what I was thinking is we would take that 1.8 digital regulator that's on the board that you have already. Like those... LD1117 regulators. It's in the little tab type package.
Mm-hmm.
And if we took that off and replaced it with two 1.8 volt regulators that are in the JSON package, they would be the same size as that package. And so they would fit. And then you would have the analog and the digital, and you'd have to add some filter caps and things like that. So we're going to have to talk about that. And you're just going to have to generate your own 1.8 locally is the way I think it's going to have to work.
Okay, well, we generated it for the analog just to make it a low noise right. source. All right, well, let me when you've settled down all the issues, let me know and go back and revisit it.
Because I'm presuming that you're probably going to want to have a separate regulator for that digital to keep the noise off the analog part, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the noise on the 1.8 volt analog input is, is got to be pretty low.
Yeah. And so then the only issue that I can find is the three pins that are the I2C port that goes to the main connector. They're the 1.8 volt I2Cs. The main control for the 3.3 volt I2C for the port expander that runs the relays, that's fine. That stays the same. But this is the one that goes to the A to D converter.
Okay. I haven't looked at the schematic in probably a year.
Yeah.
So...
It's just that port now is going to be 2.5 volts, and that will not work with the 1.8 volt regulator or A to D. The absolute maximum rating is 2 volts on those IOs. So, but it's just an I2C. So I think we could come up with an I2C level translator just to do the I2C port.
I think a resistor and a Schottky diode could do it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the only thing I can come up with that we'll have to change that voltage regulator and the I2C port levels.
Okay. Well, go ahead and finish up the data engine because it should be quick for us to revisit the receiver.
Okay. And it looks like down in that area where the regulator is, there's some room. So we might just luck out and it'll be easy to fit in.
Okay. Well, there's any board that has open real estate is a waste, right?
That's right. Might as well put something there. We'll have to move the logo, though, because that was where we had the logo, because it was open.
Well, just stencil the logo on the top of the connector.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll point out Jonathan had a couple of questions for the VLF card.
Oh, that's right. Right. So Jonathan, explain to me again about the clock. I was trying to pay attention, but I didn't.
Yeah, the clock he had right, the way we had discussed it before, where he brings the clock on differential to single-ended, uses it internally, and then sends it back out single-ended to differential.
Okay, and it'll be LVDS. The differential will be
each way. Yeah,
each way. And then however you use it on the board, that's however you want.
Right. So I think the idea there is there are you can get a single receiver, single transmitter in a single chip. But so
the whole point of that though was to keep the data coming back from him and the clock coming back
synchronous.
Right. So I can use the clock.
So if we do that, he can use a single transceiver chip that has a receiver and a transmitter in the same one. Just loop it back on itself and use the single-ended signal to drive the ADC.
Then am I not going to be one buffer delay between the data that I get and the clock?
No, shouldn't be. We're talking fairly low clock rates here. So, no, you should be all. It should be all set.
Okay, well, I thought we were talking like 50 megahertz clock rate. Is that not right?
Yeah, but the propagation delays shouldn't be a problem. I mean, you're trying to keep it synchronous. That's the way you're going to have to do it.
Mm-hmm. It's just that if you feed, you take the differential into the board and you run it into a buffer to get single-ended out and run the codecs with that, and then take that single-ended and feed it into a buffer that goes back to me, I'm going to be one buffer delay off from the data.
The propagation delay for the receiver plus the transmitter. But I thought that's how you wanted it.
What I want is the clock synchronous with the data, if that's possible. And it is if the chip gives me a clock. Like, for instance, on the receive board, the A to D converter actually has a clock output that is synchronous with the data output, which is ideal, but these codecs don't have that.
Yeah, and in actuality, you want on the receiver, the clock needs to be shifted half a bit time off, right? Because you use one edge to clock to sample.
No, actually you do it the other way around. You let the you have it all happening on the same clock edge.
Well, that's DDR from the receive. So you got a clock on both edges.
At any rate, in the receiver, it doesn't matter. It's all programmable. You can slide the clock around wherever you need it.
Audio codecs don't use DDR.
Right.
Typically, you know, in most
it's just pipeline.
The receiver samples on the middle clock edge, not on the changing clock edge.
No, we sample on the same edge.
Okay.
From my experience.
Well, in that case, if the edge is too darn close,
you rely on the propagation of the driver, data driver, to satisfy hold time.
Right. In which case, this should not be an issue.
Correct. We'll have to look at the timing, but it shouldn't be an issue. And you can either, you know, if we have that transceiver in the design, we can wire it whichever way we want, whichever works. The second question he had was 1.8 volts versus 3.3. And the core of the ADC does run off 1.8.
But I thought it ran on 1.8 or 3.3.
Can supply it with 3.3. It has an internal regulator to bring it down to the 1.8.
So you're probably going to use less power if you're running on 1.8.
Correct.
Not use the internal regulator.
And his question was that he's going to run the IO at 1.8. So should we run the core at... No.
He should run the IO at the VCC IO voltage that I give him.
Which would be what?
1.8, 2.5, or 3.3.
It may be any of the above, you're saying.
Any of the above, depending on what the...
Okay, so this is an independent question then.
Yeah.
And you said something about not having 1.8 volts to feed other boards?
Well, okay, so the way the regulators are set up is I have a regulator for each RF module. And it is strappable to 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3, each of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I supply a VCC IO to RFM0 and RFM1 independently, but that's the only place those regulators supply, and I have no 1.8 volts used anywhere else in the system. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have a 1.8 volt regulator that I can supply, even though on the RF module, we had a pin called 1.8 volts, but it's really VCCIO. And it's
right. It's RF I see. Zero so zero. That is, that's, and the point is that that's an indeterminate voltage at this right. time.
So it better run.
So you can't use that to supply a core of a chip.
You can't use it unless
you had a regulator that was
right. Well,
versatile.
I was figuring he'd use it for the VCCIO of the chip because that will run on all three of those voltages, and it really doesn't matter what they are as long as the other side of the receiver or transmitter is on the same voltage.
Yeah,
and that's well, that's the reason he gets VCCIO is because the bank that port is connected to is running on that VCCIO, so you need to be on that VCCIO also.
Yeah, I would say probably you're going to feed for the core operation of the board, probably feed at 3.3 and we would just use its internal regulator.
Yeah, okay. Because Jonathan, you get 3.3 and 5 volts, so you can do whatever you like with those. It's just that if you're going to talk to the IO, you got to talk at the VCCIO voltage that I give you.
Right.
Because that's the way it's going to be connected.
Well, is that is that voltage finalized yet or is that still up in the air?
It's strappable, so it'll be selectable on the data engine. So it has to run on any of the three.
So then...
So you can't depend upon it being any particular one of those three voltages.
Yeah, so we need to have that card be versatile. So just run that in separately from the actual supply voltage to the card.
Yeah, because I'm figuring you're just going to take the VCCIO that I give you and you're going to filter it and you're going to run it. It's digital, so then it's not going to be, noise is not going to be an issue. You're going to create your own analog voltages for your RF and your analog, but the digital side will come from a pin on the connector.
No, but what I'm saying is that is that a digital voltage finalized? Do we know what it's going to be? Or
it's 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3. It's selectable in operation of the card.
But Jonathan, it doesn't matter to the supply to the ADC because it's not available as the main power supply.
Well, right. No, I was just
wondering. And it doesn't matter if you have 1.8 on the IO, it doesn't matter that the analog core is also 1.8. It's going to be want to be a different source anyway because it's the analog core.
Right. Yeah.
So if you're being sent 3.3 volts and the chip has an onboard regulator that is known quiet, use it.
Okay. Because if we could strap the IO voltage to 3.3 volts, then I was going to run the IO VDD at 3.3 and I was going to run the analog also at 3.3.
They're not related. They do not get connected. You do not want analog connected to digital.
Yeah, no. I know, but what I was asking was is if I have to use 1.8 volts, what I was asking was, is there any benefit to running different voltages, or should I just stick with the same voltage level for both the analog and the digital?
They're not related. They're different. They're completely different. They're orthogonal.
Well, right. So then it technically doesn't matter. I can pick whatever I want.
It doesn't matter. But like David said, if you have a low noise 3.3 volt to 1.8 volt onboard regulator, use that and supply the core with 3.3 volts on from your either filtered off the connector or from your onboard 3.3 volt regulator, and then supply the VCCIO from the VCCIO pin that I give you.
Right.
And it'll be one of the three voltages, but you don't care because the core voltage will be fixed and you will decide what that is. The VCCIO will not be fixed and you will decide, you won't decide what it is. You'll take whatever I give you and that'll be whatever the user decides to strap it to. And at this point, it's likely to be 2.5 volts because that's looks like where we're going to have to strap RFM zero to make it work.
Yeah, we're going to have to look at the chip to see what it wants.
Well, I've looked at it, and it will take 1.8, 2.5, or 3.3 as the VCC IO.
No. It only takes 1.8 or 3.3.
Yeah, I don't see 2.5.
Is it 2.5
in it? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is they only specify 1.8 or 3.3.
Yeah.
Now, why it wouldn't take an intermediate, I'm not sure, but I haven't looked that deep into the data sheet yet.
Well, and the thing about it is that the inputs to me that come into FPGA pins are 3.3 volt tolerant.
Right.
So if the VCC IO is set to 1.8 and you drive 3.3 volts to me, that will still work.
Ah.
But the problem is the other way. If you're set to 3.3 and I'm driving 1.8, I don't get high enough to give you a logic high. So,
correct.
And I don't know if those inputs are 3.3 volt tolerant on the codec. And actually, come to think of it, are there really any inputs from the codec anyway? I mean, aren't they all outputs from the codec to the FPGA?
Yeah.
Well, you got to program the codec, though.
Other than the I2C.
But the I2C port is, does it run off the same VDD IO as the I2S port?
Yeah.
It does. Yeah,
and then also the clocking is coming in.
Yeah, and the clocking now that's coming in, the VCC IO for the clock that comes to you, Jonathan, is set by you. So you actually send the VCC IO voltage to the clock module to tell it what voltage you want coming back.
Okay,
we'll have to look at the clock chip to see what voltage you have to give it to get the desired IO standard coming back at you.
Okay, right. I remember you were saying that. Yeah, but if so, see, because the thing is, this codec can't use 2.5. That's why that I was concerned.
Okay, so on the clock. Seems to me I have a separate clock set of pins going to this module. Let me see what I could do. Maybe we just don't use any of the VDD IO pins, the VDD IO level pins to talk to you. We just use 3.3 volt. That would work, right? If everything was 3.3 volt?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So all digital has to be either 3.3 or 1.8. Now, since I'm going to get the M clock signal from the
on the clock module,
I'm going to get it from the converter. So
there'll be the differential of single-ended converter.
Well, you'll get something from the clock module at a voltage that you decide, and
yeah.
You do it, and then you'll take that and convert it to whatever voltage you need for the codecs.
Yeah.
And then you've got to send it back out to me at a voltage that I need, and we haven't determined that yet. So what I was saying is you could make that 3 volts, right?
Well, right. Yeah. Well, with that a dual driver, I see that David mentioned, it'll just be looped. So it'll go in, it'll loop, it'll go out to the FPGA, and then I'll just attach to that loop my differential to single-ended converter, and that'll be fed to the coder. So we don't really have to worry about that other than what we're sending back to the FPGA.
I just have to make sure I get something back at a level that I can use.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the simple thing would be to just say 3.3 volts.
3.3 volts differential?
Well,
differential standards aren't usually 3.3.
No, so. No, I mean are you taking the data from the ADC differential?
No.
Yes.
Oh.
On the RF board, yes. It's LVDS, so it's differential.
So so there has to be an LVDS converter transmitter
The LVDS goes right into the FPGA. It has LVDS receivers right on the pins. So
right.
I don't have any converters. I just
so, So this card is going to have to convert the single-ended coming out of the ADC to LVDS.
No, because it comes out of the ADC LVDS. The clock does. I get a clock and the data, all LVDS.
But the data is not LVDS.
Yes, it is.
Out of the chip?
Out of the RF, out of the ADC. Yeah, it is.
The VLF one?
No. I'm talking about the RF module.
No, but I'm talking about this one. We're talking the design of the VLF card.
Okay, so on the VLF card, if that's single, that'll be single-ended though, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. It's either 1.8 or it's 3.3 single-ended.
Right. Yeah.
Now, are you going to need that being sent LVDS?
Depends on how I hook it up, because on that card, there are LVDS IOs and they're single-ended IOs. So if there's enough single-ended IOs, then I propose we just use those and okay. not mess with the LVDS ones. And then we don't right. have this level translation problem. We just make it all 3 volts. And like you said, it's at a relatively low speed. So
do right. you know how many single-ended IOs?
Well, that's it. I think there's only about 5 IOs, right? So I'm going to get a clock from you and I'm going to have to give you the frame sync. And I'm going to
and the
basically needs clock. A master clock, a frame sync, and a bit clock.
Right, yeah. But there's two. Yeah, okay. And the bit clock and the master clock have a definite divider ratio associated with them, based upon what you pick for the how wide you pick for the ADCs and all that. Right.
Right, but I don't think that they have a required phase relationship. We need to check that.
Yeah, and I've looked, and I couldn't find any.
Yeah, so there are internal synchronizers usually there. Yeah.
So the I2S port has to have the same number of clocks, but they don't have to be in any phase relationship with the data coming in.
Right.
Right. They just have to be a multiple.
A multiple, right. And, yeah. Right.
So with there's the shutdown pin, which I want to use.
Right.
That will come from the FPGA. That'll go into the codec, and then the frame sync and the bit clock, they also come from the FPGA into the codec. And so far that's 3 single-ended, and then we have the data output coming from the codec, so that's 4 single-ended. So far, so
is it only 1 pin or 2 pins?
The data output.
Because remember on those AKM parts, it was you got 2 bits at a time.
Right. So there's a GPIO that we're going to be, that it could either be used as a second data output or a master clock input. Since we're using it as a master clock input, we're going to use TDM and we won't have to worry about that. So
you're using that as a master clock input, right? You have to use it as a master clock input, I think.
Yeah, that's how that we're going to configure it.
Yeah. So really, that's only 4 pins then. 3 outs and 1 in for the FPGA.
Plus the 2 I2C lines.
Now, I'm going to have to look into this, but it may be, since that's an optional, that's a it must be locking to the bit clock and F-sync without that. So we may not need to send it anything more than bit clock and F-sync.
Right, but I have to know what bit clock to send it, and that's going to be a divide down from the master clock, right?
Yeah.
But I'm saying that it does, its internal master clock is phase locked to something else.
Not the
it master has clock. An internal PLL that's generating its master clock.
And it comes off of what clock?
That's what we need to look at, but if the GPIO pin is an optional PLL input clock source, that means that it also has the capability of just running off the
Well, I know IO clocks. I've read about one of the modes is an auto mode where it figures out what master clock to generate based upon your bit clock.
Right.
Which means maybe he doesn't even need a master clock at all. I just give him a clock and everything runs off of that.
That's what I'm saying. We may just send the F-sync bit clock and it'll be just happy.
No. I'm not going to use that mode.
Why not?
Because I want to be able to feed the master clock. Because because with the mode that I'm going to use, it's going to clock itself front from the master clock. That'll be the lowest jitter clock. I don't want it. And so the other modes, you could use the bit clock to clock it, and then it will generate, it will use its internal PLL as the master clock from the bit clock.
So it'll look at the bit clock rate and decide what master clock rate the PLL should be set to, right? And it just sets it there. Or you tell it by I2C what rate, what multiply you want.
Well, yeah, you tell it what the multiplier is. That's why that I do believe that they have to be in phase with this mode.
But there's really nothing to be in phase, because if I supply only the bit clock and it generates the master clock, then it's responsible for making them in phase, not me, because I give it
something
only one
better
clock
for myself.
I was starting to get comments from well-meaning people that would
it'll be
say
an issue
to me,
with the
I
GPS
don't.
It'll be an issue with the time. With the time stamping.
So this is why you want to use the master clock, right?
Yeah, I don't want to rely on the internal PLL because that's going to cause error in the timestamps. That's why that I want to run off of.
Have you seen a spec that shows that as being different?
Well, since I haven't been
this
able
one to... this here I'm reading the paragraph right here. Device uses an integrated low jitter phase lock loop to generate internal clocks required for the ADC modulator digital filter engine. The device also supports an option to use bit clock GPIO1 or the GPIX pin as M clock as the audio clock source without using the PLL to reduce power consumption. However, the AD performance may degrade based on jitter from the external clock source. Well, and some processing features may not be supported.
But, you know, they're assuming that you're going to give it a crummy clock and we're not going
to. Well, no, the point is that it's very difficult to supply said clock. So they have an onboard PLL that's as good as any clock you can give it.
Well, is that true? Or is
that's what they're basically implying.
Well, see, I was reading that. And...
We would have to see... I would have to see a spec that says that using a high quality external M clock is better than the onboard phase lock loop to say that that's a good idea. But this is basically implying don't do it unless you really know what you're doing.
Well, we know what we're doing.
Well, I mean, in terms of.
Yeah, I know.
Yes, but.
Did you notice
the internal phase lock loop is going to be as good as anything you can supply it, I would think. It's not, they're saying that ADC performance may degrade based on using an external clock source. But they're saying it'll degrade.
They know what the performance of their clock is. They don't know what the performance of the external clock you give them is. So it may degrade if you give them a crappy clock, but we're not giving them a crappy clock. We're going to give them a high quality clock from the clock module.
But the chip is designed to generate its own high quality clock.
Well, maybe we...
This might be a question for an applications engineer at TI. Or this but my be... suspect, I suspect that they're saying the only reason to use an external clock is to reduce power consumption, not to improve performance.
Well, maybe we rig it up so we can do it either way. And
we could, yeah. But I mean, there's a part of me that says keep it simple.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that there's probably not a lot of aggravation or complexity that you add to just take the master clock that I'm supplying already from the clock module and use that one. Because it seems like you could feed that in and then you could program it to not use that.
Right. Yes, that's true. We could put it in there and try it both ways.
And in fact, you can go to the clock module and turn it off if you don't want it spewing all over.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be okay. But this thing is 120 dB dynamic range part. They're not going to put in a PLL that degrades that.
The internal
PLL will meet that spec.
Well, I was just concerned because I'm looking for like 50 nanosecond GPS timestamping accuracy to universal time. And
that has nothing to do with this chip.
Well, I was concerned that the PLL would introduce error to that.
No. If you had 50 nanosecond jitter on the
you're out of luck.
Internal clock, yeah, you're not getting 120 dB dynamic range. It requires sub nanosecond timing.
Well, then,
so the bottom line is we got to make this work in either case.
Yeah, I'd say wire it up so that you can do either, but I think you're not going to need to supply it a separate master clock.
I think
it'll be much more versatile that way.
Well,
Jonathan, it also seems like if we give it a particular bit clock, does it determine what the master clock is going to be based upon fixed ratios, or can you tell it any ratio you want? Or
what we could do, and this is another thing that we could do, is instead of supplying the master clock or feeding the master clock, we could feed the bit clock from the GPS DO.
Well, yes, they all come from that.
Well, we could feed it directly from the GPS DO, and then.
But if you use the bit clock as the source, then you're really going to use the PLL as the source of the master clock in the codec.
Yeah. So, if we do both scenarios, we could either feed it into the master clock or into the bit clock and then use the internal PLL. We could do it either way.
It's just you're going to add a lot of complexity if you're going to put a multiplexer on the bit clock and decide, is it going to come from the clock module or the FPGA?
Well,
now you got a multiplexer on the clock line, which is not really such a good idea.
No. So then we would have to pick either or maybe even add a jumper.
If you feed the M clock from the master clock from the clock module, that's going to be as good a clock as you're going to get on the board, other than maybe the PLL inside the chip. It's the best clock we're going to have externally. It'd be better than the FPGA. Or you could feed the FPGA clock, the bit clock from the FPGA into the, use that as your source, and then use the PLL inside the codec to generate the master clock. And you could turn the master clock off at the clock module. So you could actually run it one of two ways, having the master clock generated by the clock module and run everything off of that, or you could have the bit clock generated by the FPGA, which incidentally is going to get its source from the master clock anyway,
right?
Clock module anyway. It's just going to be slightly degraded because it's going to be going through FPGA fabric. So it's not going to be as...
I would rather get the clock directly from the GPS module.
Then use the M clock input.
Wire it all up and we'll see how it works.
So what you're saying though is you want to take the bit clock from the clock module. Master clock from the clock module.
Right, yeah. What I'm saying is that we have two options here.
Three options.
We could feed the master clock, or we could feed the bit clock and run the PLL. Those would be the two options.
Correct. But then the third option is which source to use for the bit clock, the FPGA or the clock module?
That would be the clock module.
Well, that's what you say. The problem is that I have to do the frame sync and the bit clock and latch the data on the bit clock. So you're telling me now the bit clock is going to be supplied by you?
Yes.
Right? Because
that wasn't the original plan.
It was not, but maybe it's viable. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a matter of who's doing the dividing from master clock, the chip or the FPGA.
Because, well, the whole the original plan was.
But there's a problem with doing it from the chip, and that is you do not have it synchronized to any absolute time. You have to feed it F-sync synchronized to the GPS to get it synchronized to a known time.
The F-sync has to come from the FPGA. It can't be generated by the codec.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's going to come from the bit clock or the master clock. And if it comes from the master clock, then the FPGA has to know how you programmed the part. And if it comes from the bit clock, it probably also has to know how you programmed the part.
Yes.
So.
Yes. So this application, what we're using this codec for, isn't a normal application. So there's some room to experiment here.
How do you mean it's not a normal application? It's just an ADC.
I'm talking about the time stamping.
Well, that you do externally. The chip doesn't do it.
No, but
the FPGA is going to do that.
FPGA is doing your time stamping for you.
And it's going to be based upon that bit clock and the frame sync, right?
Yeah, but I was just worried about the internal PLL in the codec.
Why? That, it's locked to what you're giving it. It has to be.
So
it's not going to jitter around.
So if we have these three ways of doing this, okay, we can feed the clock module, we can feed the bit clock or the master clock from the clock module, or we can feed the bit clock from the FPGA. Now, I'm trying to understand that what's going to be our advantage to feeding, because if we feed the bit clock from anywhere, then we have to use the internal PLL, because that's the way the chip's going to work, right? If you take the bit clock's the input, then the master clock's generated by the chip, not by us, so it's generated inside.
That may not be absolutely true.
That's what I was hearing, that's the way it was. So if that's the case, then the question is our M clock coming in going to be better than the PLL? But the real question is, if we feed the bit clock with the clock module, which is admittedly cleaner than feeding it from the FPGA, is that going to make the PLL be any cleaner? Okay, so you've got two sources of the internal PLL. Either the FPGA comes from the FPGA, the bit clock, or the bit clock coming directly from the clock module. Now, the one coming from the clock module is obviously lower jitter, but is that going to make the master clock lower jitter coming out of the PLL inside the codec? I don't know the answer. In other words, can we wreck the output of the PLL by giving it a noisy clock on the bit clock? I don't know the answer to that. I imagine if we made it noisy enough, we could, but it's not going
to. Yeah, I'm trying to find a spec on that.
Because
technically, you know, yeah, you could make it really ratty.
Yeah.
But I don't think the bit clock is going, you know, even though it's coming through an FPGA, I don't think it's going to be.
Because what's going to happen is the bit clock is going to be used for all the digital clocking inside the part, which is going to be a don't care for how ratty it is. Only when it determines the master clock frequency, because the master clock is what's going to cause the actual conversion. And that's the jitter that you want to be good, to be very low jitter.
Right.
Because that's going to cause the conversions. It's the conversion clock.
Yeah.
Not the bit clock. So bit clock can be crappy. It doesn't matter as long as the master clock is not. So, and the master clock has two sources, the PLL inside the chip or the M clock pin, right?
Yeah.
So the M clock pin is obviously a no-brainer. It comes from the clock module. It's going to be however good it's going to be, as good as we can make it. But when it comes from the internal PLL, we don't know what the performance is of that. And we don't know whether we can compromise the performance of that with the FPGA or not.
Okay, here's the line that is important to me. TI recommends using the PLL for high performance applications.
Okay.
So kind of tells us to use the PLL and not.
That's what it's saying.
No, it does say there's a applications report that it's referenced. Information on how to configure and use the device in low power mode without using the PLL.
So this sounds like a compromise type of.
That is a really special case that they're implying.
So let me ask you this: if we fed the bit clock in, do we get visibility of what master clock gets generated by the PLL?
I don't think it matters because it says it figures this all out.
Right, but all and, if we saw
what it does do is if it gets an invalid ratio of fsync to bit clock, it will send an interrupt.
Okay, but what I was getting at is if we could see the master clock that's generated by the PLL, we could measure it. We could determine its performance.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. I don't know if it can is obtain available as an output.
It's not available.
It is not. Okay.
Oh. See, because that's one that I was wary about it. Because I mean, we could trust it. We could trust the performance. And in our experiments, you know, we could take some measurements and see. But that's why that I originally wanted to ignore it and say that, well, I'm not going to use that mode because of the PLL.
So the question becomes then is what speed is the master clock going to run at? If you give it a bit clock of what 64 times, okay, you're going to get.
Well, it depends on the audio sample rate you've selected, right. And the bit time.
On the width. It depends on the width because you can use 16, 24, 32 bit conversions, right? You can select that. So if you pick 32-bit conversions and you got four channels, you got 128 bits that you have to clock out in between frame sync pulses. Because it seems to me you can program the frame sync to be either a square wave or a pulse at the beginning that says sync to that.
Yep, you can do both.
So you say sync to that, so you're going to get a pulse and then 128 clocks of data, and then mm-hmm. it's offset by three or something, so you take care of that. And then
it's
you're
not offset.
You're going to get another frame sync, and you're going to get another 128 bits of data, which is going to be your four 32-bit samples that you converted. Now, okay, so that means it's going to be, and so if you're converting it 192K, then you're going to have 192K times 128 is going to be your bit clock, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, what can we go up to, 768K? What's the maximum sample rate?
768K sample rate, I believe, is its max.
So 768,000 times 128 equals 98 megahertz. That can't be right. Because I thought the maximum was about 49 megahertz.
Well, that was at 192.
Oh, you're right.
So its maximum bit clock is 25 megahertz. They're saying 24.576, but that's the 48 kilohertz.
Yeah, that's multiple. That's that 96 megahertz divided by four.
Yeah.
Okay.
Looking at a table of all the different modes supported, and the highest bit clock is 24.576.
Well, so that means you're not going to be able to do four channels of 32-bit at 768K sample and get the data out unless you use more than one bit of data at a time.
I don't think you... Yeah, there aren't 32 bits to be had.
I thought it was 32 was the maximum. No?
24-bit audio is what's standard. The rest of the bits would be padded.
So in that table you've got there, it's only 24 bits maximum? Because I remember seeing a table that went up to 32 bits. So, but that data sheet is pretty huge.
Yes.
Well,
I'm looking at the switching characteristics right now. I'm trying to see if there's anything that specifies maximum jitter on these clocks, and it doesn't have it. Fascinating. They must have a really good PLL.
And
which I think they do.
Yeah, maybe it is. Because in the data sheet, that's the mode that they kind of recommended.
Yeah, they're basically saying, you can run an external master clock, but do so at your own risk.
Yeah.
It will meet full specs using the internal PLL. Yeah. Because I'm not finding any jitter specs, which is really interesting, because in the older parts where you were supplying the master clock, we had to be very careful about jitter.
And maybe their PLL?
Their PLL is... takes that all out. But I would have thought that there would be at least a maximum jitter spec to meet their analog performance, but I'm not seeing it. It's probably a question for the apps engineer on it.
And it is a new part, and maybe they just did not include that spec. I don't know.
No, it's more likely, more that it just wasn't specified. And if you want to know, you have to ask.
Yeah.
That's how we do things in this business.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things you let the user ask.
It's a way to filter out your inexperienced users, right?
In part. But no, I wasn't the applications engineer on these parts for analog devices, so I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you've dealt with the questions, right?
Right.
Okay, well then.
I would say, we can wire it up to be able to run in either mode, but I suspect that we're going to just want to have the FPGA generate these clocks, and they will have a known relationship to the GPS pulse per second.
Yeah, because it'll be digitally divided.
Correct. As long as we keep ground balance down to a minimum, should be fine.
So would you think that there would be more benefit to running, if we're going to use the PLL, then would there be more benefit to running the bit clock from the GPSDO?
No.
As opposed to from the FPGA?
Yeah. No, you're going to want it synchronized to the FSync, which the FPGA would be doing.
But I could do that. I mean, I could take the bit clock as an input and sync and generate FSync from it.
Right. That may be at least a mode that we want available.
But then you'd have to drive the bit clock from the FPGA instead of from the clock module. I mean, here's what we can do is there ought to be a way to do it either way with the strapping option on the VLF board, because we did this on the RF generator, on the RF module, is the RF module takes a clock from the clock module, and it also takes a clock from the FPGA. Now, you don't want to generally clock the ADC from the FPGA because of the crummy clock that you're going to get. However, if you don't have a clock module and you don't care, I mean, you're going to get lower performance, but you're going to get a much cheaper board, then you can change a couple of resistors on the RF module and you can use the clock from the FPGA. But there's no way, I wasn't going to put a buffer or a multiplexer or anything in line. It's actually resistors that you change from this position to this position. And we cleverly laid it out so that there's no stubs, depending on which way you put the resistors. So you can't, but you have to physically go in and unsolder resistors and move them to change the clock, which you would have to do on the clock on the RF module if we did it this way. No buffer, no multiplexer, just route it from two different places with zero ohm resistors. You could do that. And then you could build some one way and you could build some the other way and you could test them and you could see which is better. And you're probably going to find out that, like Dave says, the PLL is the best way and never mind the other ways.
Right.
But then you got to say, well, should we take the PLL? Should we take the bit clock input directly from the clock module or should we take it from the FPGA? As far as the data out, it doesn't make a whit of difference. But as far as generating the M clock internally, it might make a difference.
Well, I still want to take the bit clock from...
Oh, by the way, I just came up with a thing that supports what I was saying about what edge you clock data on. Bit clock output clock frequency must be lower than 18.5 megahertz if the SD out data line is latched on the opposite bit clock edge polarity than the edge used by the device to transmit SD out data. Okay. Which is to say they all happen, the correct way of doing it is it all happens on the same edge.
Okay, and then it takes it on the following edge.
No, it doesn't take it on the following edge of the same polarity.
Oh, okay. So you get a full clock cycle of setup time.
So, right. So you do not want to be latching it on the falling edge. You want to latch it on the same edge as the data was driven out.
Okay. But I can have a clock of latency, right? Because it doesn't, we're talking about generating the frame sync, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I take the bit clock as an input.
Yeah, I've got to take a look at the timing diagram, but it does specify bit clock period, high and low pulse duration, and then F-sync setup time and hold time.
To the bit clock.
To bit clock, correct.
Okay.
Figure 3. So.
Okay. But I still think that we should feed the bit, we should get the bit clock from the clock module and then also feed it into the FPGA.
Yeah, if we, yeah, that would be the cleanest.
But yeah, that's
looking like it implies that the PLL is being run from BitClock, which would make sense. And then FSync is being synchronized from BitClock. And it gives you the setup time and the hold time for FSync.
It would be better if the FPGA generated BitClock and FrameSync and it came off of the clock module.
Well, we need to look at this, but I suspect that the cleanest would be to get the bit clock from the clock module and have it being fed to the FPGA and to the VLF card. And then the FPGA generates the FSync. Yeah. And that then it's FSync that also needs to be synchronized to the pulse per second. Which just means pulse per second initializes some counter somewhere.
Yeah. So, and the thing is that I've got clock inputs coming from the clock module directly to the FPGA. And theoretically, we can program the outputs to be phase synchronous. So you would not need to feed me a clock from the VLF module. I could get one from the clock module that will be the same exact phase and clarity as what the clock module is feeding the VLF.
Right.
Module.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So then we wouldn't need, we'd just take the clock input, feed it into the bit clock.
Yes.
And then I would be responsible for getting the same, programming the clock module to give me the same clock output that you're getting.
Yeah.
And then use that to generate frame sync and to take the data.
Yeah.
And that would simplify the clocking on your board, Jonathan, because you wouldn't have to do all that funky buffering.
No, I would only just need the converter.
Just take an LVDS. In fact, you could actually program the clock module to give you a single-ended output if that's what you wanted.
And then would you still get a?
I can do the same thing. I can program a single-ended also, or I could do. I don't know what. If you program one output of the clock module to be LVDS and one to be single-ended, I don't know what the phase relationship is between the two.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, it well if. Maybe
you know, that's almost better if you buffer the bit clock and send it to me. So you take an LVDS take an LVDS receiver off of the clock module to single ended, and you take it to two single ended outputs. One goes to your codec, and one goes to me single ended. Then they're synchronous. So I see the exact same thing that your bit clock sees.
Right.
And then I can use that to generate frame sync and to take the data, and I don't have to worry about programming the clock to be the same. And
now, what's interesting about their diagram here is they're basically you could create frame sync. The chain frame sync can change on the falling edge of bit clock because the bit clock has to be 18 nanoseconds.
18 megahertz?
Right. No, 18 nanoseconds between rising edge to falling edge. Or falling edge to rising edge.
That's 49 megahertz, right?
But that's there are two specs. First, it can be a minimum of 40 nanosecond period, which is 25 megahertz. But then each high time and low time has to be a minimum of 18 nanoseconds. That's just saying where in that can the
40 to 60% duty cycle then.
Correct. And then the FSync has an 8 nanosecond hold time or setup time. So you could change it on the rising edge of bit clock, but you'd have to make sure it stayed around for 8 nanoseconds. The easiest thing is to just make a change on the falling edge of bit clock, and it meets all the timing specs, as long as you don't incur too much delay in generation and sending it back out.
Okay.
There's a fair amount of leeway in there that we can, with fast buffers, you're not going to have any problem setting it up. We should set up a good, an actual timing diagram for it, but it looks like it's going to be pretty simple to
program the FPGA with the setup and hold times that are needed and see if you meet timing.
Yep. But feeding bit clock straight from GPS from the clock card. It's going to be the cleanest.
And bit clock is a single-ended input, right?
Yep. Yes. You could send it differential, but it's used internally, single-ended.
But there's only one pin is what I'm getting at.
Correct.
So if you did that, you'd feed that into BitClock, and you would use that GPIO pin, Jonathan, as the BitClock input?
No, that's master clock.
Yeah, that would be unused.
There's a dedicated BitClock and F-Sync.
So then it becomes an input.
It's an input. Yeah.
Well, so that GPIO pin is either unused, or if you want to use I2S instead of TDM, it becomes the second data output.
Okay. Now, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm looking at the pin operation here. So
there are a number of different modes for it, but
yeah,
it's essentially
SD.
For normal modes, it's extraneous. For what they consider.
Okay, so then what we would be doing is we'd be taking the data out and SD out. We'd be being fed the B clock. We would generate the frame sync. So the FPGA would take B clock in, would generate frame sync back to the codec, and it would take the data synchronous with the frame sync, well, for synchronous with the B clock.
Correct.
And then the GPIO-1 would just be not used.
Right. But yeah, we could send a programmable master clock to it if we wanted to, but I really don't think that's necessary. BitClock is the key here.
Yeah, so if you were to use it in the master clock mode, you'd feed master clock into GPIO-1, right? And then the BitClock would not be used. It would be an output, rather.
No. You still would use it as an input.
Yeah.
Oh.
But they do have the mode of running master clock and having BitClock and F-Sync generated internally, but you're not going to be able to synchronize that.
Okay.
That's a standalone mode that's not what...
This inherently is the problem that I was looking at is, okay, so suppose we run GPIO-1 as the master clock input from the clock module.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have to generate BClock and F-Sync off of that.
Right.
Yeah.
What phase relationship does it have? I found that nowhere.
Yeah, it's not in there.
So how do I generate B clock? Because master clock is going to be faster than B clock, right? Because it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an unspecified thing. And my experience is that these chips will internally synchronize master clock and the incoming B clock and F syncs. If they're not being generated internally, they're synchronized and they have synchronizers to figure that out.
B clock and the F sync would be synchronized with the master clock coming in on GPIO-1, so everything would be synchronized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it would internally figure out what edge it would be clocking it on.
But in terms of how we're going to wire this up, it sounds like the B clock comes from the clock generator and GPIO comes from nothing. So you can't run. I suppose you could feed GPIO and B clock from the same clock. That wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Because in the case where you're going to run GPIO-1 as an M clock input, then you got to run B clock as a different input.
Now, I'll point out I've already pointed out that running it in master mode is a whole nother data sheet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. There's another application.
They call it an application mode, report.
Master mode being when you feed M clock in on GPIO-1, right?
Right. Yeah. Feed your own master clock in, and then you have the chip generating the bit clock.
So they're really telling you not to do that kind of then, right?
That's how I'd put it. That's how I take it.
Well, so it sounds like the best thing is to feed the B clock from the clock generator.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll generate an F-Sync through the FPGA. That bit, from what I'm reading here, bit clock is the key. That's what you want to keep clean. Yeah. F-Sync can jitter around quite a bit.
Yeah.
It just needs to be within a window of being able to be synchronized.
Well, it has to, and it also has to be the correct number of bit clocks. Why?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to count it properly. And it will shut down internally if you get it wrong.
Yeah. So then the only question is, are you going to send me a buffered copy of BClock? And I suggest that we do it that way.
Yeah, we could have it I don't think that's a big deal, as long as we keep the buffer delays down and can meet those timing specs. It's probably, but there's also nothing that says you can't have it fed in parallel from the clock module.
Say that again.
Well, can't the clock module send it to both cards?
No, it can't. It won't send the same output, but you can generate two outputs out of that synthesizer chip that are synchronous outputs.
Yeah, they have to be synchronous.
They're it's designed to do that. So
if you
program all the features the same.
And I guess we also want the edge of bit clock to be synchronous with pulse per second. Because the F-sync is going to come from bit clock.
Well, it's good. The output is going to be phase locked to the 10 megahertz. That's
right.
Adjusted by the GPS.
Right. But it has to have a known phase relationship to pulse per second.
How are we going to do that?
There are ways to synchronize that. We have to do it.
Because you're talking about just to get the timestamp correct, right? That's what this is for?
Yeah.
So, because what I'm figuring is the FPGA is going to keep an accurate timestamp value, and it's going to be updated every pulse per second.
Yes.
And it's going to be updated, and that pulse per second coming from the GPS is, that's the thing that's within 50 nanoseconds of when the time changes.
Yeah.
When the timestamp changes.
Right.
So then whatever the timestamp value is when the 16 or the data value from the VLF module comes in, that's what timestamp it gets.
Yeah.
So you'll be within whatever the accuracy of the 1 PPS is, that's what you're going to get as your timestamp. Just have to make sure if the timestamp changes at the same time, you don't do something wacky. But typically that's easy enough to do, and you synchronize it with the high speed clock so that, you know, the amount of uncertainty is only, you know, 8 nanoseconds or 16 nanoseconds.
And since we're getting that from the clock module, then we should be okay.
Well, the problem is that I don't know the timing relationship between the 1 PPS and the frequency of the clock that you're going to get out, that's your bit clock.
Yeah, that may be problematic. There may be uncertainty there.
But the uncertainty is going to be in terms of plus or minus a tick at 18 megahertz or 25 megahertz, whatever the maximum frequency is.
Right, but that's 40 nanoseconds. That's within your 50 nanosecond spec, but still.
Yeah.
You can do better, and there's got to be a way to. Yeah, This is coming out of the Silicon Labs chip.
The the PPS?
Yeah. No, not the PPS, but the bit clock.
The bit clock, yep.
Yeah.
But so the GPS is going to feed into, see if I get this, if I remember the architecture. I wish Tom was still here. He would know how this goes. But the synchronization occurs inside the synthesizer chip. So we're going to be feeding it a GPS 10 megahertz input.
Yeah, but 10 megahertz doesn't tell you phase relationship to pulse per second.
That's true.
And this is going to be an odd ratio.
Actually, the PPS,
to the 10 megahertz.
It's going to be unrelated, I think.
Well, no, it's got to be related. It's got to be the 10 megahertz is phase locked to the pulse per second.
Well, so
or better be
fixed relationship there,
right?
If you're
phase, the audio clock, the 24 point whatever clock, is only going to be essentially synchronous to the 10 megahertz on the 1 PPS boundary.
Well, but it can't be because it's a different frequency
on the 1 PPS boundary. It still has to add up to a second's worth.
I guess that's true. Your least common denominator is 1 second worth of counts.
Right. The least common denominator is actually at a kilohertz, but because at least if you're doing something based on the 48 kilohertz, it's a multiple of that. But like 24.576 megahertz has a relationship to 1 kilohertz.
But
still.
I'm still wondering, though, how important this is, because every audio sample, this audio sample is going to be sampled at, 192 kilohertz or 384 kilohertz. That's a lot of 10 megahertz clocks. And you're only going to get every 384K, you're going to get one audio sample, or you're going to get your four audio samples. So how to, okay, so I'm going to see all the bits come in at the end of the bit time when I got all 24 bits for all four channels. There's the mark. That's the point at which I say that's the timestamp. But those samples were sampled in the past.
Yeah, but there's a known time relationship.
So then
they
I adjust my time sample to take into account the latency of when the actual...
Or it just be measured in data analysis. You subtract that out.
Okay. And how will we know what that is? Because it's going to be...
A measurement.
It'll be dependent upon the rate at which you are clocking the codec. Because it'll be different if you're sampling at 48 kilohertz.
Right. Well, you have to come up with a spec for whatever modes that you're operating.
Just so long as it's determinable.
Because remember, the digital filter will also have a
That's true.
Finite delay that you have to take into account. But, you know, under any given mode, if you keep the conditions the same, it should have...
Should be deterministic.
A deterministic delay.
Okay, so then what it comes down to is we have the shutdown going from the FPGA to the codec. We have the frame sync going from the FPGA to the codec. We have the bit clock and the data going from the codec to the FPGA. And then we have the I2C interface, which is two lines, which are bidirectional. Well, the clock comes from the FPGA and the data goes both ways.
Right.
And do you foresee anything else, Jonathan, for I/O?
No, that's it. As long as we could, so with the bit clock, if I'm going to feed the clock back to you, am I going to feed it single-ended?
Yes.
Or yes.
Single-ended. Okay.
So then, what I need? Do you think that the output of the converter could drive both the codec and the pin.
No, you have to have two outputs because you don't want to chain the outputs like that if you can avoid it, because it won't be a nice signal.
What are you chaining?
Well, he wants to take the output of the differential receiver from the clock module and just feed it to both the bit clock input and the connector going to the FPGA, just like a Y. I don't think.
Yeah, we would have to buffer it and. Yeah.
So what you do is you take a buffer, you feed the, you could probably find one of these, an LVDSN and two single-ended outs.
Okay.
And the delay between the two single-ended outs is picoseconds because they're matched, because they're in the same part, on the same die.
Yeah.
And then you feed one to the codec and one to the FPGA. And then that means I see that bit clock at exactly the same time your codec does.
Okay. All right.
I mean, plus the connector delay, you know, the... Won't be exactly the same, but it'll be very close.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I'm here at the leaf module connector, and right now I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got 7 differential lines that are running on VCC IO, which you're not going to use. Okay, I have the PPS signal. And let's see, from the clock module to the FPGA. Yeah. So didn't you say, Jonathan, you needed the PPS signal for something?
No. Well, that's going to go into the FPGA. And the timestamping is going to be done in the FPGA. I don't need it.
I have the PPS from the GPS going to both you and the FPGA. So if you need it, it's there.
Oh, yeah, that would be like a debugging.
Okay, so it's not really necessary then.
No, I mean, because I think I originally said that I wanted it so I could feed it in as an audio input to one of the inputs. But
Okay. Somehow to measure the latency.
It's just historical that. A common way of synchronizing audio channels is to feed the PPS into one channel. And then you have it in your record.
Yeah, because that's how Paul does it in his software. But see, Paul is dealing with multiple clocks here, where we're only just dealing with one.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're able to actually synchronize it directly rather than having to try to get a time sync into an asynchronous system.
Yeah.
So right. Right.
So we just do all that timestamp and synchronization in the FPGA, and you won't do anything on your board.
Right. Now, one thing you're talking about 10 megahertz to the bit clock. This is the bit clock wouldn't come off the 10 megahertz. It would come off the 122 megahertz.
It would come off the synthesizer chip that has 10 outputs that are programmable from the clock.
Why wouldn't it come from the 122? That's why it's 122.88.
Well,
that's an audio frequency.
Okay, but you can't feed 122.88 to the codec, right?
You have to divide that down. I thought that the clock module would be doing that.
Clock module is, it just has the synthesizer on it, which it does divide down.
Yeah, but not from the 1222 megahertz, well, which is the high performance clock.
I mean, what you want is 49 megahertz synchronous with 122.88. And I don't see how you're going to get that because it's not a multiple. So,
no, it is. I don't know where you're getting 49, but.
Oh, because that's you're clocking the input at 48K, 128K, you know, whatever.
Right. No, but the 122.88 megahertz is actually a multiple of 12.288,
right,
which is a fundamental clock rate for 48 kilohertz sampling.
Let's see what you could do then is the Silicon Lab synthesizer chip has, like, I think 6 separate synthesizers on it, digital controlled synthesizers,
which, right,
fractional end synthesizers. So you could actually run the VCOs for each of the synthesizers at 122.88 or a multiple of that, and then divide them down synchronously, and you'd end up with synchronous outputs.
Yeah.
I believe that would work. I mean, that's kind of what it's designed to do, I think.
Right. I mean, we're going to have to think about this this clock system.
I wish we could get John Ackerman on here to attend the meeting here and talk to us about this, because he would know whether this is a possibility. And
yeah, why doesn't he get on this?
He's pretty busy, and it's late, and it's late for him. He's not a late guy, I think. So,
yeah,
just like I'm not an early riser. So,
but he's at the far end of the time zone.
Yes, right. So it shouldn't be that hard, right? So anyway, let me take a look at this and what
more is going to need to be discussed about the clock system, but I think we understand how the ADC is going to get fed.
And here's the other thing we could do, like for the shutdown input to the codec, we could make that like an open collector input. Okay.
Yeah.
And because it's going to the codec, I can take a pin off of my 1.5 volt bank, and I can make it, because I believe it's active low. Is that not, hold on, I've got the pin out right here. If it doesn't have the shutdown pin on it, nice. Oh, there it is up here. Shutdown is active low.
Active low, yeah.
Yeah.
So what we could do is we could feed that from a 1.5 volt output of the FPGA and just make it open drain and put a pull up to whatever voltage you're using.
Okay.
Because it doesn't have to be fast. It's not
right.
No path. So, and so then I need an output and two inputs plus an I2C.
Yeah.
And again, the I2C is open collector anyway, so we can make that work. But I got a couple of spare pins for that that are on VCCIO34, which is the 3 voltages. That really leaves only 3 pins that have to be fixed, of which 2 of them are your output. So you could make those 3.3, and I could hook them pretty much anywhere.
Okay.
And then the frame sync is the only one that has to be 3.3, and I think I can scrounge up a single. In fact, I think I have a 3.3 volt output. No, I don't.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to Okay, so I need to fix that.
So then I'll make IOVDD on the codec 3.3 volts, and we'll run it there.
Okay, so you're going, because you have a VCC IO from the leaf to the clock module.
Yeah.
You specify that IO, and that's what clock voltage you're going to get back. So you could do that anything you want. I don't care. And it doesn't have to be the same as anything else. It's just that if you set it to 3.3, you're going to get a 3.3 volt. So you need to look at the synthesizer chip and see what happens when you give it, because each of the 10 outputs has its own VCC IO, and that's what that's connected to. So you need to go back to the Silicon Labs chip and see what you're going to get for your 3.3 volts that you give it.
Well, we don't really have to worry about that because we're going to use the converter.
Oh, right. But if you want to make it LVDS, you got to give it the right voltage to get LVDS, and I don't know what that voltage is. And this is what screwed us over on the FPGA, was that in order to get 1.8 volt LVDS, you have to set the bank to 2.5 volts, which is counterintuitive. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So, but that makes the VCC IO 2.5, which is not correct for driving any of the other signals that aren't LVDS. So right. It gives you a problem. So if you use it, so whatever clock chip you pick, you have to make sure that that Silicon Labs chip will drive it directly, because that's what's connected to the pins. There's no buffer. The buffer is there. I mean, I should say there's no separate buffer. The clock part has buffers built into it.
Yeah.
So, and you know the part number of that part, right? Do I need to give it to you? The one on the clock module?
Yeah, which one is he using?
He is using, one second, I will...
It's a 53 something, right?
There's so many of them that have gone by so many times, I don't really... I'll tell you that what's in the schematic now I know is the right one, because that's the one that we put in. So, okay, it's a 5345A.
Okay.
SI5345A.
Okay.
-D. And there is a difference between the A is on all parts, and then there's an A through D part. So you got to pick the right one.
Okay.
SI5345A-D.
Then what clock frequency is it being fed, or does it have multiple choices?
I asked that. Supposedly 48 to 52 megahertz, but I don't have an answer yet because I haven't gotten hold of the Raycon guy to tell me what clock frequencies I can get.
Why isn't it derived from the 122? That's our good clock, and everything wants to be synchronous to it.
Well, we don't have a clock generator for 122.
Where is that coming from?
It's coming from the synthesizer. So we take 50 megahertz input, and then a 10 megahertz reference from the GPS, and we synthesize 122.88.
From the 10 megahertz.
So there's GPS not an actual 122.
That's correct.
0.88 oscillator?
That's correct.
Aye. That's not how it's supposed to be.
So, John,
I guess we could make one if we wanted to put a low performance clock module on there and skip the GPS and put a 122.88 oscillator on it. But this is what John came up with to generate our frequencies. So
I really wish he'd be in more contact about the design of the clock card, because he's been making some strange design choices that don't fit with how we usually use.
Well, at least one of the things we do have is we have the option for an external input, clock input. So if you want to feed something different than that into.
But then you have to develop your own.
And you do.
GPSDO. This is supposed to have been the GPSDO.
Well, let's corral him and get him to come on here and explain it for us.
Okay.
So I'm sure
more shall be revealed. I've got to go to bed.
Yeah. I got to go to bed too. I was up. I got no sleep last night, so I'm zoned out here.
Yeah. Well, we've resolved some things and generated more questions.
Well, still, we made some pretty good progress here.
Yeah.
I understand what you're trying to do, Jonathan. We need to try to get the clock system to do it properly.
Yeah.
I agree that you want to have the system time synchronous. If we can do it to 50 nanoseconds, that would be great. Even at VLF, it is important.
Yeah.
So I have a clock input coming from the clock module, and then I have a single-ended clock output going from directly from the VLF to the FPGA, which is where you're going to drive your bit clock out to me. And then I just have to make sure we get the data output and the coda and the FS, the frame sync input over right. to you.
Yeah. And the frame sync has to have a synchronization to pulse per second.
Okay.
So that we know within a certain, window when the samples are starting.
Well, so if we were to just hold frame sync off until the first pulse per second comes in and then synchronize it to that, then mm-hmm. that's sufficient. Then it,
yeah, basically.
The PLL will basically line itself up with it.
Right. As long as it stays that way for the rest of time. But you can set it up so that every now and then it gets, even every second, it synchronizes.
It resynchronizes? Yeah, we can do that.
Resyncs.
Yeah.
Especially on F-Sync, because you don't, as I pointed out, it can jitter a few nanoseconds either way, and it's not going to be a problem. It's bit clock we need to keep clean.
Well, as long as you...
Relatively clean.
As long as you have the right number of bit clocks between frame syncs, you can't...
Well, yeah, that better not change.
Yeah.
No, that's got to be at a set counter.
Yeah.
But, the frame sync will be derived from the bit clocks, but it wants to be when there's a pulse per second comes in, that's what wants to start an F-sync.
Right.
Yeah.
And then as long as all the clocks are synchronous, they will stay put.
It's just that you can't be moving frame sync around to realign it with pulse per second.
No, you don't have to move it around. It won't be moving around. Better not be jittering. You don't want bit clock to be jittering relative to pulse per second either.
Because there's going to be an integral number of bit clocks pulse per second, right?
Now, is this pulse per second direct out of the GPS receiver, or is it a...
Yes, yes.
Then what happens when you lose...
You're screwed. What do they call it? Holdover?
Holdover. What do you mean there's no holdover? That's the whole point of the system.
There's a holdover for the clock based upon the high-performance oscillator that we have, but there's no GPS. There's no PPS because it comes from the GPS. Now, and I take that back, there's no holdover. The PPS, when you lose a satellite lock, mm-hmm. I don't know what the PPS does. I don't know does it drift? Is it?
We need to know what it does.
Yeah, that's a John question, because I don't...
Having it just jump around.
On the Trimble, if you lose GPS lock, the GPS's internal oscillator keeps that going.
What happens when it gets back into lock?
Do you jump or do you slowly...
Yeah, there are two ways of doing it. One is you shift frequency to bring it back in slowly, or the other is you jam sync.
Which is boom, move it over.
Right.
I believe it's brought in slowly on the Trimble.
Yeah, well,
on the U-blocks? I mean, that's the question. U-blocks is what we're using.
Yeah.
Well, normally on the GPS modules, at least with the Trimble, if you lose satellite lock, then the internal oscillator keeps it going, and that has some drift.
So you're and still going to get one PPS too, right?
Yeah, it'll still...
You still, yeah, usually they'll continue on a PPS, but you can... A lot of them, you can set them to either jam sync it or drift it in.
Right, yeah.
We need to know what it is.
But John,
and this is not a Trimble. This is a John.
John's talking about what happens when you lose lock. And what happens is you get NMEA sentences that tell you you lost lock. So therefore, you get enough time to say, hey, the one PPS isn't valid anymore because we lost lock. And so you'll get a one PPS, but it might not be exactly on the second. So,
yeah. Well,
anyway, because we were talking about what do you do in that case? Do you stop the one PPS because it's not valid anymore? It's too far off, or what? And that was one of the things that we debated: is We can monitor the NMEA sentences, and we could jam the 1 megahertz, the 1 PPS low if it was not accurate. So then you'd be obvious you lost lock.
Anyway, we need to talk about this later because we don't have all the information.